turns out okay, it's 11, so let's do 3 hours.
Okay, so I watched some clips last night, and honestly, the 70s had like zero DEI oversight.
Yeah, this has been a recurring issue with a lot of our legacy titles. We've discussed digital character integration or possibly adding a contextual disclaimer before playback. European horror is having a major moment right now.
Wait, is the devil's French?
I mean, probably. British movies are basically French adjacent.
I just think we need to be sensitive because 70s directors were kind of intense.
Totally.
Was Ken Russell problematic?
Was he considered indie?
Back then, all foreign directors were basically indie.
I honestly thought The Devils was an A24 movie until yesterday.
Okay, wait. Was this the villain?
No, I think Oliver Reed was.
Honestly, all the men in this movie feel like villains.
Apparently, this whole thing happened in, like, Spain.
Okay, first of all, how do you even pronounce this? Luden? No, I think it's Ludon.
Wait, was this supposed to be Italy?
Somewhere in Europe?
Honestly, I'm not even convinced this happened.
No, literally. This feels like one of those fake patriarchal panic stories men invented to punish women.
And somehow he's the hero? Okay, I'm sorry, but this man is literally terrifying.
No, seriously. His energy feels violently pre-therapy.
Was this considered attractive in the 70s? Unfortunately, yes.
The yelling, the sweating, the emotional instability. You can actually feel the masculinity coming through the screen.
Oh my God, can you imagine him at brunch?
Everything about 70s male actors feels unsafe.
The masculine performance happening here is honestly exhausting. He's sweaty in like an emotionally threatening way.
Mm. And yet?
Unfortunately, the toxicity is testing incredibly well.
Okay, this is honestly kind of offensive. The way these women are filmed, it's just male hysteria project onto female bodies.
It's basically 70s sex elation.
The nuns are literally crawling all over the place screaming while the camera just
objectifies them.
Straight men in the 70s were deeply unwell.
Okay, but this whole era of filmmaking was like aggressively masculine?
No, totally.
Oliver Reed literally radiates toxic energy.
Right,
yeah, totally.
Didn't actors in the 70s just scream at women constantly?
Apparently that was considered intensity back then.
I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't release it. I just think we need to acknowledge the violence of the male gaze.
We might think about having a male gaze disclaimer in some release markets.
Yeah, but clips of him yelling are testing insanely well.
Exactly.
Online.
He's just another charismatic toxic male narcissist. And everybody in the movie treats him like this tragic Martin because 70s cinema was obsessed with tortured macho men. Like, he literally radiates emotional danger. Women in the 70s had no choice but to romanticize men like this. Unfortunately, audiences seem very attracted to his energy.
I'm sorry, but this guy is literally the embodiment of violent male ego.
No, seriously.
Everything about 70s masculinity feels emotionally dangerous.
Apparently he was basically like this in real life too. The only footage I've ever seen of him is him getting drunk on some old talk show and horrifying everyone.
Yes!
I saw clips of that.
How can something so lucrative leave no cultural footprint whatsoever?
A woman will never, ever forgive a man that he fucks her. She is the receiver.
He never forgives him if he doesn't.
I'll buy that, sir. I'll buy that. So we walk in every plank, in every regiment, in every corps, in everything, but you are the receivers. You take our seed, you look after our babies, and we'll go do the hunting for you.
Yeah, I don't believe in them.
Some poor female journalist was clearly uncomfortable, and he just kept getting more wasted. Classic 70s male pig behavior. And somehow this is still considered charisma?
Unfortunately, yes.
We've spent years trying these macho abusive archetypes, and now younger horror audiences are rediscovering them as based cinema. I honestly thought culture had evolved past this.
Avatar wasn't cinema. Avatar was the feelies. Brave New World has its equivalent of the cinema. Huxley called it the feelies, a dystopic extrapolation from the talkies that emerged in and around the 1920s. Films with sound, with talking, with singing. They sent Huxley into paroxysms of curmudgeonly rage, ranting against the debasement of the human psyche and the human intellect unavoidably inflicted on the audience by modern entertainment. Indecency, decadence, decay, and the spiritual void. The talkies offered, to use a sentence of his, nothing but disembodied entertainers gesticulating flatly on the screen and making gramophone-like noises as they did so. So, in Brave New World, we get the feelies. The feelies convey no meaning. They contain no real message. They aren't designed to challenge you or to make you think. They aren't really a narrative art form at all. They are all designed to delight the base senses: touch, sight, sound, and smell. They tell no stories because Brave New World doesn't allow stories to be told. It's all about keeping people comfortable. They bypass the part of the brain that makes you think, and they target the part of the brain that makes you feel. What makes the feelies sinister is not that they impact you, it is that they do not. At least, not consciously. The cynicism at their core is that they do not view the audience as thinking agents to be persuaded, but as bipedal fleshy canisters containing a cocktail of neurochemicals. What we take for reason and rationality, our opinions, wants, desires, beliefs, these are the mere products of that cocktail. Change the dose, change the balance, change the man.
This measures the individual portions.
What's the dosage? 0.01 milliliters. Very potent substance.
We've improved our distillation process over the years. This one barrel contains over 4 billion doses.
Splendid.
Brave New World Revisited, which was published about 2 years ago, you did claim that much of what you forecast had come true. I mean, for example, the use of drugs and this instance of people having their thoughts directed while they're asleep through music being played or messages being played through their pillows and so on. I mean, in which societies do you think that most of what you forecast has mostly come true? And is it in America, Britain, Russia, China?
Well, it seems to me this is not so much... you can't say that it's a question of national peculiarities or even entirely of political peculiarities. I mean, I think when the technological and applied scientific means are developed, they just tend to be used. I mean, I think one can say that the whole history of recent times in relation to science and technology shows that if you plant the seed of applied science or technology, it proceeds to grow, and it grows according to the laws of its own being. And the laws of its being are not necessarily the same as the laws of our being. I mean, hence this sense of which so many people have, and which I think one sees in so many societies, this sense that man is being subjected to his own inventions, that he is now the victim of his own technology and the victim of his own applied science, instead of being in control of it.
Suppose that this rather frightful prospect comes about. I mean, are people going to be happy under this kind of regime?
Well, I think you could. I mean, this was one of the sort of what I may call the messages of Brave New World, that it is possible to make people contented with their servitude. I think this can be done. I think it has been done in the past, but I think it could be done even more effectively now, because you can provide them with bread and circuses, and you can provide them with endless amounts of distractions and propaganda.
Christianity is stupid.
Approach general ideas. I mean, is the best way of expounding general ideas to expound them in abstract terms, which is, of course, the philosophical method, or should one try to write one's philosophy through the medium of individual case histories? This is what I have more and more tried to do. I mean, for example, in the three historical pieces I've ever written, these were essentially attempts to express general, in the widest sense, philosophical ideas in terms of particular case histories. I mean, there's this book I wrote about Father Joseph, the Grey Eminence, the book I wrote about the devils of Loudun, and then this long essay I wrote on Maine de Biron. I would like very much to find another good sort of biographical historical episode. That turned up, I mean, very years and years ago, I read the account in Michelet's book La Sorcière of the Loudun case, and was interested, and incidentally found when I came to look into the documents that it was extremely inaccurate. I mean, this great historian was very slapdash about the way he handled his account of the case. But then I thought no more about it for many years, and then quite by chance picked up in a second-hand bookshop the 19th century reprint in a limited edition of the autobiography of the Prioress and one of Surin's autobiographical things, and the late 17th century book by Aubin on the, which is an account of the whole episode. And reading those, I was so fascinated. I mean, there was such extraordinary material there that I began collecting it and found it. But in fact, I don't think any historical episode has ever had so much documentation.
And so we were up all today very early. Am I correct that apart from irresistible entertainment, the movie is saying something that you consider to be urgent?
Oh, absolutely. Real? Absolutely. From the late 60s and that kind of formative period for me, and that was also the beginning of the environmental movement. And when I was in high school, one of the plays that we put on was a play that I wrote called Extinction Syndrome. And it was about our human proclivity to destroy ourselves and the world around us. And it was an anti-war screed, and it was about pollution, a bunch of other stuff. It was very sophomoric, but the point is that I was thinking about that stuff then, and I was thinking about it a lot when I wrote Avatar, because by then we were in Iraq, so all the sort of colonial period reference points, the historical reference points, were now resonating in the exact present moment. So now you have a combination of the comments on corporate special interest groups and lobbies sort of hijacking the democratic process and being responsible for the degradation of the environment and all that sort of thing, and our kind of overall
kind of denial of that. And these are all things that made sense to me.
The Na'vi bear a strong resemblance in their behavior and their predicament to the Native Americans and other threatened indigenous people.
Right. As humans in an industrialized society, we have a kind of entitled feeling with respect to nature, that we can take what we want and we don't have to give back. And that feeling of entitlement is also behind the idea that when, you know, Europeans with their guns and horses and armor and so on came to the New World, they had a sense of entitlement. Right. What they could take, they would take. And they did. You know, and that's in our human nature. It's something we need to recognize in ourselves, and it's something that if we don't correct, we're going to drive off a cliff at 90 miles an hour with the top down and the radio playing in about 10 to 20 years.
There are autobiographical statements by the Priories, by Father Seurat, great many letters. All the exorcisms were taken down in shorthand. Great many of them are printed, and of course a vast number still remain unprinted, but probably I never read any of the unprinted material because I just can't manage those things. But I don't think they would have contributed anything because most of the exorcisms are very like one another, so that a reasonable cross-section of them probably represented the whole fairly clearly. Then there were great many accounts by outsiders who come to look at the possessions. It became one of the sort of popular tourist resorts in 17th century Europe, and people went from all over the continent to see these nuns rolling about on the floor and screaming obscenities. It was obviously the greatest fun. These nuns, of course, were their own lunatic asylum. I mean, the whole convent was a lunatic asylum, with this screaming and with these exorcists deliberately keeping the thing up. I mean, the behavior of the exorcists, there's a degree of revoltingness and bad faith, which is absolutely appalling. After Grandier had been burned, they sent for the Jesuits to go, but the nuns remained just as much possessed and hysterical as ever. And as the Capuchins had failed completely in their efforts at exorcism, they called for the Jesuits, and among whom was this remarkable, very, very able man, but very unstable, psychologically unstable man. Seurat came from Bordeaux, and he undertook not merely to dispossess the Priories, but also to raise her to the highest pitch of mystical perfection. And in the process, himself became psychologically infected and fell into a state of complete insanity in which he remained for 20 years, finally emerging, and in the last 7 or 8 years of his life, becoming one of the major figures in the French 17th century mysticism. And even while he was insane, when he couldn't, he was so sort of hopelessly down that he couldn't read or write or could hardly even move, he was able to dictate a work on the spiritual life, which I've read. It's in 3 duodecimo volumes of about 1,200 pages, admirably well organized, with copious quotations from the Gospels and from the Fathers. This man who couldn't read or write, I mean, showing that the whole of his intellectual faculties were completely intact, while his emotional and physiological condition was absolutely disastrous. I mean, this man was completely incapable of doing anything at all and was, in fact, a raving lunatic, which is, of course, one of the strangest facts about mental illness, that you can have these cases. I mean, I've seen them in contemporary life of people whose intellectual faculties are perfectly sound, and yet whose emotional life is so disturbed that they have to remain locked up in institutions for years at a stretch. One of the oddest paradoxes, I think. The whole business of the legal and psychological aspects of witchcraft in the 17th century, very, very interesting. I read a lot about it at the time. Very interesting to see how, if you don't have a theory of the unconscious, You're virtually forced into the idea of possession. I mean, I think all the exorcists were convinced that this was a genuine diabolic possession. And, of course, they were being paid by the government. They were all getting salaries. When the publicity wore off and people got bored with it, the whole possession disappeared. I mean, the nuns were under pressure from the exorcists to go on performing. And when the money ran out, because they were being paid a subsidy by Richelieu, and they cut the subsidy off after a time, and the public opinion got bored, and they all got well. And then the extraordinary thing, the Paris then made this tour of France exactly like a movie star, because she fabricated false stigmata on her hand, which she showed. She used to sit in a window with her hand hanging out, and thousands of people would come and examine these letters which were written on their hand, supposedly by supernatural means. And she went to visit the king and queen, had a most wonderful time. And then again, that was all over. I mean, it was like a sort of Marilyn Monroe procession through the country. And then, very pathetically, I mean, she became convinced that she was a sort of second St. Teresa and was going to be a great mystical saint. But of course, in fact, she wasn't. And was sort of acting the part of a great mystical saint. But in the end, she developed cancer, and a lay woman came to live in the monastery, who was a genuinely spiritual person. And it's very touching. I mean, she ended up as quite a humble, genuinely Christian figure in the end. I mean, she made a good ending in the language of the church. I mean, she really understood her own defects and this endless play acting that she'd been doing all her life. But of course, the really strange thing about this whole story is that the whole Loudun affair is interesting only if you take the two sides together. If you take the case of Grandier and then the case of Turin. Between them, the two episodes describe the religious life on every level, from the most horrible to the most sublime. I mean, the whole gamut of religious life is set forth in a kind of parabolic form in these two episodes. Now, the really extraordinary thing is that, as far as I know, I was the first person to bring these two episodes together in a single volume. Plenty of French people have written about Grandier, and in recent times, plenty of people have written about Seurat. But nobody has thought fit to put the two cases together in a single volume and illustrate this fantastic spectrum of the religious life, from the most revolting to through the most equivocal to the most sublime. I mean, this is the whole sort of message of this extraordinary episode, that religion is infinitely ambivalent. I mean, that it has these wonderful sides to it and these appalling sides to it. And the interesting thing to do in discussing it, of course, is to bring out both aspects. And here is a story which is strictly historical, and I really never departed from the historical documents, which is at the same time a parable. And this is what I'm looking for, is a historical or biographical medium in terms of which I can think about all sorts of general subjects and philosophical subjects. Because I do strongly feel that philosophical and religious ideas are much better expressed, not in abstract terms, but in terms of concrete case histories, biographical or historical. And if you can find the right kind of case histories, you can find means of writing what may be called philosophy. I mean, this perhaps is too presumptuous a term for what I've written, but I mean, it does permit the expression of general ideas in a much more powerful and penetrating way than would be possible if we were just writing about the same things in abstract terms.
this place, doing this kind of thing?
The Navi took a long time to design, but the blue color was never in question because I felt that it was a fundamentally alien skin color that could be quite beautiful. But the idea that they incorporated animal-like features, cat's ears and cat tails and a slightly more protrusive muzzle and a kind of a flatter, more feline nose, big eyes, lemur-like eyes, this was all something that we arrived at over the course of designing these characters. We initially started out with kind of more amphibian-like and reptilian kind of forms and alien structures, you know, kind of antennae and things like that. And we kept realizing that it wouldn't work as a love story to see them not be attractive, but they couldn't be human. And then they kept coming back to just blue-skinned humans. I said, well, that's no good either. So we have to find ways of pushing away from human, but in a way that people would not find off-putting, and in fact might even find to be kind of quite beautiful. I wanted people to say, I want to be one of them.
Everybody.
Kenneth, the original negative has been restored on Earth.
Wonderful.
People are calling it a masterpiece.
They could have mentioned that in 1971. So, did the Vatican survive?
Inside this room are films the church has judged spiritually dangerous.
You're serious?
Does this look like a joke to you?
For 50 years, these elements have remained sealed from the world, and the 70mm British blow-up print, our most protected possession.
All this for a movie?
Perhaps now the public is finally ready.
Ready? This blasphemy is never to be seen! We should have burned it in 1971! Destroyed it years ago! Destroy it! Burn it! Burn this filth before it spreads again! It curses everyone!
There is a way you can make a film where no one can remember it.
Satan!
Beelzebub!
Leviathan!
Asmodeus!
Abaddon!
Thank you.
preside over this land. By the favor of our Lord Satan, I have the power to grant your wishes, should it please me to do so. Waste no moment in unnecessary babbling, or you will incur my anger. Now, lift up your heads and tell me your desire. Who seeks entry here? Enter, penitent, that you may abase yourself before the only true God.
What's that sort of dreamy noise in the background there?
Penitent.
Oh, it's a groaning, boring, kind of miserable, whiny, boring kind of sort of boring noise going on.
Here to be, and believe.
I deny God, creator of life.
Kiss the goat! As the shavings of the clock do never return to the clock from which they are taken, so may your soul never return to heaven. Now, remove your garments and lie down at full length upon the altar. Worth set. We heard the bonds of ignorance and superstition.
It is desecration.
Jesus flooding out of the black.
For half a century, we protected this film from the world.
And now?
Now the world resembles the film.
You really believe this picture has power?
My son, power is the only reason anyone hides anything.
You invite Satan through weakness and vanity! Satan, savior of the grave!
Satan!
How could they photograph such things? Russell was insane.
This must never leave the vault.
Pain cleanses the flesh for God's divine entry.
There are collectors in London offering fortunes for complete prints.
And those collectors are foolish men.
You really think the release of this film would matter after all these years?
Do you know how many men wanted these reels released? Neither do we.
For 50 years, this sickness has remained under our protection.
People are asking again. Restoration houses, festivals.
There were rumors. People inside the studio tried to release it in the 1970s.
Yes. And those people disappeared. Some doors must remain sealed forever.
Burned the negative in 1971.
And if someone restores it privately?
Then we bury them with the film.
No restoration. No interview screenings. This abomination remains buried forever.
Kenneth! They are trying it again. We are in spiritual war with the church again. They are trying to stop it.
Oh, good Lord. What would the physical world be without conflict?
Whatever the Lord says, we will do it.
Eva, Ave, Satanas. Vade, Lilith. Vade, Retro Pan. Deus, Maledictus, Est. Gloria, Tibi. Domine, Lucifere. Per omnia sacula saculorum. Amen. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Reike Satanas.
Hail Satan.
Ave Satanas.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Ah!
Christina Sagala. I'm the third-year playwright.
Hi, Christina.
Hi. When I saw Avatar, one of the things that really struck me is I was just so caught up in the story that I didn't realize, like, how many political messages there were.
When I turned the script in to the studio, I got a lot of pushback along the line of, you know, can we cut down on the, let's see, new age hippie tree hugger bullshit? From a trusted friend and confidant of mine at the studio. And I said, theoretically we could, but then I wouldn't want to make the film, because that's why I want to make the film. So we just have to trust that we can attract an audience through the visuals and the promise of action and adventure, and then they're going to have to go on that ride. And y'all are just going to have to sit down and shut up about it. That's just me again, but that's what I believe.
Thank you.
the young and the restless.
Jonas, if something is going on with me, I want to know what it is.
Tell me about your baby.
My baby? What are you talking about? I don't have a baby.
Yes, you do.
What did they do to him?
The doctors say he should not even be alive.
I won't have my wife embarrassing me with this women's liberation nonsense.
I'm not your property, Stephen.
Oh, God, what did they do to him?
That's what you get for emptying an entire can of Aquanet on your hair.
I'm trying to save this family!